I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
Beneath the surface of the perfect small town, a dark world awaits.
Are you the one that found the ear?
You know anything?
Well, one name that keeps coming up is this woman Singer.
I'll bet someone could learn a lot by getting into that woman's apartment.
I don't know if you're a detective or a pervert.
Well, that's for me to know and you to find out.
What are you doing in my apartment?
I close my eyes.
Are you a bad boy?
Hey! Who is this?
You're like me.
Don't be a good neighbor to her.
I'll send you straight to her!
Here's to an interesting experience, huh?
I'll drink to that.
Hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and now YouTube channel where two guys get together. We talk about science fiction, horror, films, television episodes, some other things, key influences on the particular topic of the week, and then things that topic may have influenced going forward, especially if it's an older one. We've been doing this for, it seems like, 100 years. Tim and I have been talking about movies, and we've also we're covering 100 years worth of movies almost. Several seasons in now, you're welcome to look down there and find other episodes and other films that you might want to hear our opinions on or give yours. Speaking of giving yours, if you're new, we'd love to know how you found out about us. Did you hear it from a friend? Did you just stumble upon us in the dark? Are you just doom scrolling and found us? Whatever. Leave a comment down below and say where you found us. And if you're returning, then obviously we did something right the last time and you're back, which is a good thing. We try to start with a little icebreaker every week. Tim, ice break it. What have you done anything genre-related?
Oh, let me get my pickaxe out here. I'll break some
your
ice.
Pickaxe. Ice it, baby.
Okay, yeah. Like you said, we normally start with something we may have done in our genre week, and I was looking for something that might be a bit of a segue into today's topic, so I chose 1977's Eraserhead.
Ooh, really? Interesting. Okay.
And I don't, a lot of people do classify this as a horror movie. I'm not really sure. It definitely fits into some body horror. I'm not sure I would totally pigeonhole it in the horror genre. I really don't think there's any genre you can pigeonhole this film into.
Art film. You could say art film.
Yeah, it's very surrealistic, very indulgent.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in 40 years. So when I watched it, and I did watch it last night, I can watch it a little more objectively, but it is still very strange. It's directed by David Lynch. One of the, I guess it's the one that really put him on the map other than short student films. As I mentioned, it came out in 77.
What was his first film?
Yeah, it was his first feature-length film, for sure.
Yeah.
It came out in 77, as I mentioned, and it became a cult movie. However, I was a little young in 77 and did not start going to midnight movies until about 5 years later. So I never saw it in a theater when it was playing midnight movies. I remember it playing midnight movies with movies like Dawn of the Dead and Harold and Maude and Rocky Horror Picture Show and things like that. The cast is okay. It primarily just features one familiar face, and that's Jack Nance, who's in that poster behind me as Henry Spencer. I never realized until I was watching it about halfway through last night, that's the guy that plays Pete Bertel in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
The very first line, gone fishing. The first line from Twin Peaks.
The line I remember is, don't drink that coffee.
There's a fish in the percolator.
Right.
I think Lynch loved Nance because he was so quirky in his deliveries, always.
He doesn't hardly speak so in this movie at all.
Except his line is just introducing himself. I'm Ted or whatever his name is.
Henry Spencer.
Yeah. I'm talking about in the movie we're covering today.
Oh, in the line. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Gotcha. Anyway, he died young in 1996, like right after Twin Peaks filmed. I didn't realize that he had died so
unfortunately.
Young. The reason I can appreciate this movie, Eraserhead, a little more, though, is because of the cinematography and the sound, which are really good. It's shot in gorgeous black and white, and it is genuinely weird and disturbing. A synopsis is Henry Spencer is a man navigating a bleak industrial landscape while dealing with the anxiety of fatherhood, an unhappy relationship, and caring for his severely deformed, crying newborn child. The black and white film is known for its dreamlike, disturbing imagery, such as The Lady in the Radiator, and is widely interpreted as a metaphor for deep-seated fears regarding responsibility, marriage, and parenthood. That's why it's called Eraserhead.
I think it'll come up in our discussion today of Lynch's artistic influence.
I agree. We're going to get into that. Before I move on, though, this one gets 87% on Rotten Tomatoes. It is one of his higher rated films. I'm not sure I get why, though. Other than being beautiful, it's bizarre and at times incomprehensible. Puzzles me, and we'll talk about this probably too, that after The Elephant Man, he was offered things like Return of the Jedi and Dune. And I'm like, it is clear that he is not that kind of director. Why would you offer him those properties? Especially with what we've seen now that he did Dune.
There's a whole history of Dune. From Jurovsky, I think, is the one that worked on it forever. That's also where all the alien guys came from, so to speak. But before it went to Lynch world. Hmm. So there was an entire history that goes. I think we talked about it a little bit when we covered Dune a couple of years ago.
We did.
But I would never. We'll talk about it when we get into his overview, but there's a stylistic and thematic through lines and tropes that are definitively David Lynch. And when he tries to put those into other films, I don't think they work.
No, it's funny because, and I don't want to give away too much, but next week's film is a director. Oh, shit, I can't do it without giving it away. I'm just going to say that David Lynch, to me, is much more of a David Cronenberg-type director. He's very indulgent and very into body horror, and he's not a big movie director. He is a small movie director. And I think Lynch and Cronenberg have that in common, and I just don't see why someone would go, oh, Star Wars. It just makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah. No, I would agree with you. I don't know why he would ever be even considered for that or why he was. But obviously, he was a flavor of the month at the time, sort of thing.
But that's what I did in my genre week. I decided to go back to his first and see if I remembered what I remembered.
Which is great. I should have done that too, because I'm like you. I haven't seen that film probably since I watched it on VHS decades ago, mostly because it's not my... I didn't enjoy it at the time. So, yeah, it would be interesting for me to revisit it, like you said, and appreciate it a little bit more now with all the old age and stuff.
Yeah, all the experience we've had since seeing it as kids.
I went in science fiction world and read a novel, and it... I found out, like, halfway through reading it that it was turned into a series that I wasn't even aware of. Anyway, it was a film. It was a novel by Martha Wells called All Systems Red, and found out that it is the first in a, I think it's like a 6 or 7 novel series called The Murder Bot Diaries. And it was turned into a series. Let me see if I got in my notes who did it. Apple TV did it. Called Murderbot, and it stars Alexander.
Oh, yeah. I've been looking at that. I was wondering if it was any good.
If it's, what do you call it, true to the novels, or to the at least the first novel, I think it'll be great. It was a really compelling read. It was very interesting. It's basically taken from the POV of a sentient security cyborg robot who is assigned by this big corporation to protect these scientists on this planet. But he has removed his governor, as they call it. So he is totally not controlled by anyone and is totally sentient. And it's so funny because it's a very Stephen King-y writing style, because a lot of it is his internal dialogue, and it's really good. Like, he'll look and he'll go, oh, I guess I should act like I should smile at these humans now. Like that for some freaking reason. And yeah, he's very cynical and he's very dark. But he also has no moral conscience because he's a security robot. His initial programming is to defend and protect. So if things are bad, he has no qualms with killing people and everything else. But I'm assuming the series of novels will end up examining his morality, okay, so to speak. I think he'll develop a conscience, because he does by the end of this. He essentially, without giving it away, he essentially becomes a free agent and not owned by the corporation or anybody by the end of the novel. So he's free to roam and go do stuff, which I'm sure is what he will do. It's very kind of prescient for now for AI and where AI is developing and all of that, and that whole AI fear thing, which kind of it plays into. The original novel came out actually in 17. And I thought you would find this interesting because I looked it up. The first novel is called All Systems Red, came out in 17. The next 3 novels she published in 18, all 3. So evidently, she was on a roll. And then the next one came out in 20, and the next one 21.
Some people write fast. Some people write slow. Some people now in the self-publishing world write and build up so that they can release them one after the other and capture the algorithms of sales.
That's actually a smart idea. Yeah.
So she might have been sitting on them and decided, I'm going to release one, and then in 2 months I'm going to release another one, and then in 2 months I'm going to
release one, see if it gets a nibble and it hits it off, and go, oh, I have 3 more ready.
Yeah, the lines are all blurred between traditional publishing and self-publishing now. And self-publishing is no longer anathema like it used to be, because everyone was like, self-publishing, the world is going to be drowned with horrible crap. And now they're saying it about AI, same exact thing. Oh, now we're going to be drowned in crap again because of AI. But it's not the case, because the crap doesn't float to the top.
I know from romantasy world that, yeah, self-publishing is like a big deal.
Oh, it's humongous. Yeah. It has been for almost 20 years now. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I watched a little thing. I read a little thing called
All Systems Red.
The Murder Bot Diaries, All Systems Red. And you went back and gave a great segue already to our topic of the week.
Yeah, which is also about murder, and it's David Lynch style. We're going to go back to 1986's Blue Velvet. a quick synopsis.
Hence the music that you'll probably be hearing right now.
The a la Angelo Badalamenti.
Yeah, his variations on a lot of songs in this one. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's one song in this that, if I'm not mistaken, is in Twin Peaks as well. I seem to remember that. Or it seemed very similar. I can't remember.
There is a love theme that he plays for Jeffrey and... What's her name? Sandy.
Sandy, yeah.
That is very similar to Laura's theme.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Anyway, a quick synopsis. Blue Velvet, it begins when a college student, Jeffrey Beaumont, played by Kyle MacLachlan, discovers a severed human ear in a quiet suburban field. The gruesome find draws him into a dark investigation beginning beneath his town's seemingly idyllic surface, for lack of better words. With the help of he takes the ear to a detective, and the detective's going to look into it. I think it's fairly funny how they are so nonchalant about it. He says, here you go. But he decides to start conducting his own investigation with the detective's daughter, Sandy. And with her, they discover a connection to a troubled nightclub singer named Dorothy Valens, played by Isabella Rossellini. Dorothy is trapped in an abusive relationship. It's actually abusive. It's sadomasochist. And it's with a criminal named Frank Booth, played by Dennis Hopper. There's a really good, like, voyeuristic scene in there where Jeffrey is in the apartment of Dorothy's because she has seduced him, and then she pushes him into a closet because Frank comes, and he gets to watch the whole routine between Frank and Dorothy, which is pretty out there.
Yep.
I can probably leave it at that. I've got some notes. He becomes entangled in their dangerous world. He confronts violence, sexual obsession, and the contrast between innocence and corruption, which is kind of like a big underlying motif of this entire film. It explores the underbelly of small town America and, you know, what lurks beneath the facade of normalcy. And I'll just leave it at that. What is your history with this movie? And I'm really curious.
I honestly don't remember when I first saw this film. I cannot remember. For some reason, I'm thinking I saw it after I saw Peaks, but I don't know.
I think you saw it before, because I think I may have watched it with you.
I think so, too. I go back and forth because I go, no, I had to have watched it before, because then when Peaks came out, Joe was so excited, because Joe Powell loved this movie. And he's, because of his thing with he was working at the newspaper at the time, he had an advanced screening of the two first episodes of Twin Peaks.
Okay.
So we got to see them early. And he was just freaked out because how similar to Blue Velvet it was and how all these tropes were the same and yada, yada. And that just turned us all onto Twin Peaks. I think, but I do remember, I think I remember saying the first time I saw this movie that I feel the way Lynch wanted me to feel, which is very uncomfortable after watching it. His darkness versus light, and the fact that both are in all of us, and how much do you give in to each side, and can you live with both dualities kind of thing, is such a Lynchian trope anyway. But I didn't know that at the time when I watched this movie. I had only seen Eraserhead once prior to this, and I had seen... I had to have seen this when it came out, because I saw Elephant Man before I saw this movie.
Elephant Man was 1980. This was 1986. Dune came in between, and he had gone down. So this was his comeback.
Yeah. But I remember just feeling very uncomfortable about the characters in it, very because there's no outright heroes in this. Mm. There's a lot of eccentricity in this film. So in any Lynch film, there is. So you have to, okay, we're gonna have a guy in white makeup acting effeminate, singing into a work light. Okay, sure.
Yeah,
I guess
Roy
if that's
Orbison.
What if that's what we're doing for this scene? I guess we're doing that then, huh? He's very. We talk a lot about movies that pull you in, and then that one little thing happens, and it pulls you out of it, the experience, and makes you realize you're watching a movie, and yada yada. Lynch's artifice is that all the time. He wants you to be jarred a lot, either by something somebody says, some weird quirk that somebody has, some weird montage he suddenly throws you into. So he wants you to be very well aware you are watching a cinematic experience all the time.
Yeah. I was no longer living in Morristown when Twin Peaks aired, because that was the 90s.
Right.
Yep. But I had watched Eraserhead and this movie on videotape, most likely with you.
I would think so too, yes.
However, I never saw Dune, and I'm not, probably because it just didn't interest me. Eraserhead, if I made the connection that it was the same director, Eraserhead was just out there to me. This, I remember just, I was like, this doesn't do it for me. I don't really care what's going on. And I think it's because of what I said earlier. I think he's, and you say eccentric, I say indulgent. It seems like
both.
He just wants
yes.
to film what makes him giddy, and he doesn't really care what anyone else thinks.
Totally agree. Totally agree with that, with both of those. It is indulgent. It's usually focused on something that's eccentric, something that's excessive, something that he knows
shocking.
Is like taboo or shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
However,
I was going to say,
going back, like I did with Eraserhead, I can appreciate it a little bit more now in retrospect. However, I do think Twin Peaks was probably his swan song. Compared to this, because I think Lynch on television was much more bizarre because you're putting this crazy shit in front of all of America, not just the cinephiles. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think we'll get to it when we get into later discussion, but I think Lynch was tempered, I think, by the television medium itself. I think it restrained him more, which was better. I also think he was extremely constrained by Mark Frost. And I have always said, I think Mark Frost is really the
kingpin.
The reason Twin Peaks worked. Lynch is the ripped out, still bleeding heart being eaten by a small baby that's at the center of Twin Peaks. But Mark Frost is the person who dressed it, coordinated it,
okay.
had the characters and the plot lines and all that.
I haven't watched the series since it aired, and I have it on DVD. I've got like a Blu-ray of it. So I need to go back and revisit it. But I respect your opinion there, because you guys used to watch it religiously. I remember that.
We had Twin Peaks parties.
Yeah.
We loved Twin Peaks. And I still do. I can appreciate it for especially the first season. Second season starts to fall apart.
That's exactly what Rotten Tomatoes say. It's like the first season is high and the second season is low. So that's funny.
Yeah. And then the third season that he tried to resurrect 25 years later is not really worth anything.
Okay.
So, and I'm sure if you're a Lynchophile out there, please tell me, please defend him, and especially in what they call Twin Peaks The Return, or essentially the third season, which was, I think, in 17 or 18. Please tell me what was good about that. So,
I've got a little bit of background, because I don't know that much about David Lynch, but
uh-huh.
I've got that he was married and had children with four women, which is a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was also in an extended relationship with Isabella Rossellini. And she basically said that he was her guy, like in her whole life. He's the one she remembers the most. I've got that this was voted one of the greatest films of all time by Entertainment Weekly in 1999. I would disagree with that.
I would too.
Then after screening, Dino De Laurentiis, who produced this movie, said, nobody's going to want to distribute this picture, so I'm going to form my own distribution company and distribute it.
It's one of my first watch notes is Dino De Laurentiis. Oh, wow. I've forgotten about him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He did so many Stephen King movies in the 80s. Oh, my God.
And remember, he produced Dune, too.
He did.
Lynch's Dune was Dino as well.
Yeah. You got to give Dino a little bit of credit to having the vision to let some of these guys do what they want without unbridled talent, I guess. Mm-hmm. But that's really all I have, unless you have some background. We can move on to scenes. Or
I do have his daughter. I think it's his first. I'm not sure what relationship it was. But one of his children is Jennifer Lynch.
Yes.
Who's another director who's done a bunch of television. I think she even did Wayward Pines and a couple of other. She definitely has her dad's unique look at stuff, but not as graphic.
Yeah. She did a horror movie that was popular. Was it Jennifer's Body she did, maybe?
No, the Boxing Helena.
Oh, Boxing Helena. It? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was her. Again, body horror, like you said. It must run in the family.
It's Julian Sands and the girl from Dune, the blonde girl, isn't it?
I thought it was the girl from Twin Peaks. I thought it was Audrey from Twin Peaks, wasn't it?
Oh, well, you know what? You may be right. Sherilyn Fenn.
What's her name? Sherilyn Fenn. Yeah.
Yeah, and Julian Sands. That's where he like cuts off pieces of her body or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that. Okay, yeah. So David Lynch's daughter is a director as well. So he's got some descending.
And I think his personality spills over into a lot of his work. Just backstory on him, I know that just certain things that we learned in the cult following of Peaks, he likes his coffee black as midnight on a moonless night, which was actually a line that they put into Peaks. And he likes his bacon nuclear, charred beyond belief sort of thing. He was a constant chain smoker and smoked all the time.
Oh, that explains his skin. He always looked wrinkled and craggly. Yeah.
Yeah. And his fingers, his hands too, everything else. He also giggled a lot at totally inappropriate times. So
I have that in common with him sometimes.
Yes, you do. Actually, I would agree with that one. But he put a lot of that into characters. Like in season two of Twin Peaks, he is actually a character. He is Cooper's boss, who is an FBI agent, head of an FBI segment, who wears hearing aids and still can't hear very well, so he yells all of his lines. So somebody will go, agent, would you like to come over here? Okay, I'll be right over. And that's the way. So he himself, when he acts.
I had forgotten about that, but I do remember it now.
Yeah. Scenes.
Oh, my God.
My first one is always, again, for this one would be the opening. He sets it up perfectly with this, the music and this, which is a gorgeous version of Blue Velvet. And then these beautiful red roses and literally white picket fences and firemen waving at you as they drive by in like a parade. It is so
raw
small town America. And then the camera literally does this kind of descent below the flowers and the grass and everything into the darkness, and it starts showing bugs eating things and worms and all this, and the sound gets to that.
Yeah.
And then you cut to a sprinkler head. So I was going, okay, yeah, that's a great hook. It was a great hook.
And that the beginning, when it shows the picket fence and the rose, it's almost like a picture. It's not even like a film. It's like a painting.
And it's gorgeous. Yeah. Yes, the colors are so and it's interesting. The colors are so vibrant in these bookends. That's obviously, he meant to do that.
Yeah.
Because we end that way too. We end with everything very brightly colored, very light.
It's a happy ending. Yeah.
Yeah.
Surprisingly.
But everything in the middle is very muted colors and muted tones. And even in the picture behind you, the pink Sandy's wearing isn't pink. It's a very muted kind of pink kind of thing. So all of his color choices are very different once he gets into the underbelly of our small town.
Other scene, the finding the ear scene is always sticks out with me because that's such an odd thing to happen, to find a human ear.
Yeah, you're just looking for a rock and, oh, there's a human ear on the ground here. And wait, what would we do today? Oh, immediately pop the cell phone out, call the cops, have them come look at it, get CSI here, everything else. Mm-hmm. Instead, Jeffrey just picks it up, puts it in an envelope, says, I'm going to take this with me to the cops.
He finds a paper bag. Yeah, he tosses it in there, rolls it up and
puts it in there.
I'm like, I don't want to touch that.
Yeah, I wouldn't need, no. Human ear. It's not just like you found an organ.
Plus, it's got a little mold growing on it. It's old. Yeah.
It's been there for a day or two. Yeah.
What else? There's so many very memorable scenes in this. The scene with the first scene with Frank and Dorothy.
Yeah, that pseudo rape, voyeuristic, oh my God scene. Mm-hmm. The scene right before that when she is seducing him. Mm-hmm. That's an intense scene.
And she pokes him with a knife in the cheek. Yeah, she was like, damn.
Cuts him. She pokes him. It disappears in the next scene and then comes back in the scene after that, but that's okay. Okay. We'll give them that. The Dean Stockwell scene is odd, bizarre, strange.
It's basically a little solo performance of him lip-syncing In Dreams by Roy Orbison.
But the whole scene, of course,
is he lip-syncing or is he really singing? I can't remember.
He's lip-syncing because he puts it in the cassette. But the whole, that whole scene from when Frank arrives on, just Stockwell's character and what he is, and bring the glasses. Would you bring the glasses, dear? And all that. And in doing some research, they said in the screenplay and in a lot of the reviews that this is a brothel. I did not get brothel out of it at all. There were a bunch of overweight, eccentric-looking weird people who never said anything. There's a locked door, which supposedly her husband and son are behind. And then you've got the Stockwell character. What was his name? Bobby? No. Whatever his name was. Ben.
Ben, yeah.
Who is very eccentric to an extreme. So, that was a scene. One for me. Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say the scene where they think they're being chased by Frank and it ends up being Sandy's ex-boyfriend who's pissed off because his girl has been stolen by Jeffrey, and they get in front of his house and you think there's going to be a fight, and all of a sudden Isabella and Rossellini comes running out completely naked.
Yep. And beaten up.
Yes.
Severely beaten up. And
when I was watching this, of course, we're going to talk about these kind of things. The first thing I thought was, how the fuck does she know where he lives?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. She never went to his house. She don't know where he lives, and yet she's there.
Jeffrey, he's a neighbor. Jeffrey, he's a neighbor, Frank.
Yeah.
Fuck Jeffrey. Yeah. But for me, a scene, just because I'm a Twin Peaks guy, is the second scene in the diner with Sandy and Jeffrey, because it is so Twin Peaks. It's after he's done his stakeout and he's trying to tell her, but just that low angle from the table, looking up at both of them talk, and he has the most cryptic, weird dialogue about the man in the yellow coat went out and talked to a gentleman holding a lizard skin briefcase. And you're going,
a well-dressed
what
man.
What the hell is going on? Yeah. A well-dressed man. Yeah. And you're going, what the hell is going on? Right. I don't understand.
It's very, it's a key I add, X-Files, because in X-Files, they don't have character names. They have the well-manicured man. They have.
Oh, that's true. That's a great key. Yeah. That is really good.
Yeah, it's very similar.
But it was just really odd and unique, though. Yeah. But it's very Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks had a lot of exposition dumping at the diner kind of thing, where we go in there, Harry, I need you to do this for me because I saw this and this. And then what do we know? We know this reinstatement of the mystery.
Yeah. The only other thing I can think of off the top of my head as far as scenes is that there's always a lot of pretty good suspense with him seeing something either through the blinds and you're like, oh no, he's going to get caught, or he's back in the closet at the end of the film when Frank comes in and he's hiding, making Frank think he's in the bedroom. But there's also the scene where he's looking out the window and sees the car pull up where Frank's coming before Frank gets in the building. So there's a lot of good suspense in the movie.
Yes, I agree with that. And there's also Lynchian moments in it that are, like I said, he'll cut, like whether it's Sandy having a nightmare or a dream or Jeffrey having a nightmare or just transition scenes where, you know, intense candle and then the candle blows out and we cut to something else and a fire burning. And yeah, this artsy montages
yeah.
he does. So it's those are strange. In there as well. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you want to move on from scenes, we can go to the cast, which for a small movie like this movie's got a great cast. It's like an all-star cast, especially now. Back then, some of these people were lesser known, but now they're very well known. Some of them were well known at the time, though. But I've got them listed in it, not in any particular order. I start with Isabella Rossellini. She plays Dorothy, obviously. We know her from latter movies like Death Becomes Her, and I know her personally from the comedy, the sitcom, it's not a sitcom, but the comedy show 30 Rock. She's one of Jack's love interests on that, and she's got an affinity for Arby's beef and cheddar, which is just hilarious to see Isabella Rossellini obsess over beef and cheddars, but...
Yeah.
This role was originally written for Debbie Harry. Did you know that?
I did know that, but she said no because of what, Videodrome?
Because of Videodrome. She said that she was tired of playing weirdos, and I think it's very ironic that here's another Lynch and Cronenberg connection is Debbie Harry. He originally...
However, reading it, I didn't get the impression that that Dorothy Valens was a weirdo in this. Not like the chick in Videodrome. She was crazy in Videodrome.
True. She...
Dorothy's more a victim.
She is a victim. She's being blackmailed, and she's also probably addicted as well. So that adds to it.
Yeah.
David Lynch initially envisioned Hannah Shigula for the role of Dorothy. I don't know who that is.
I don't either.
Okay. I guess it's a foreign actress, maybe. When she declined, he decided for Helen Mirren to do it. Helen Mirren.
Oh, Helen Mirren?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
She turned down the role, but she happened to be the one to suggest that the character should be a mother. So he got the idea of Dorothy having a kid from Helen, even though she didn't play the part.
Interesting. That, see, to me, that changes her whole motivation. If he gave me a script and in the script it's just my husband has been kidnapped,
yeah,
as opposed to my husband and my child, I could totally see that changing a character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I can see that.
Karen Allen, Rebecca De Mornay, Jodie Foster, Angelica Houston, Diane Keaton, Sybil Shepherd, Sissy Spacek, and Meryl Streep were all considered for the role.
Wow.
Out of all of those, I could see Sissy Spacek doing it.
I could see, who's the second one you said?
Rebecca De Mornay.
Yeah, I could see her doing it too.
Yeah, I don't see Karen Allen at all.
No. And Meryl Streep, no.
No. Maybe Angelica Houston. She's got an Isabella quality to her.
She does, but I think it would be very hard for her to do the vulnerable part of that. She's very strong.
But I can't see Jodie Foster doing it. I can't see Diane Keaton doing it. I can't see Sybil Shepherd doing it. Although it would be a star turn for Sybil if she could pull it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Deborah Winger turned it down due to the erotic nature.
Makes sense.
And Helen Hunt was considered, but she was too young. Sigourney Weaver was interested in playing the role, but she had already moved on to other projects.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
So Sigourney's pretty brave when it comes to stuff like that. And in 1986, that was the same year as Aliens. So she was busy.
Yeah. Ghostbusters had already come out. She was.
Top, so Isabella Rossellini got the role. Now, She and Lynch would later be engaged from 1986 to 1990. So like I said, they were together for 4 years, but never married. I've got that she was actually naked under that velvet robe when she did the ritualistic rape scene, a fact that her partner, Dennis Hopper, was not aware of until the camera started rolling. And when she opens her legs for him to kneel between, it's all there.
She was naked.
She is naked, and it was the very first time the two of them had worked together.
I didn't know that. It was the first scene that they shot together. Yeah.
So pretty. I wonder what was going through Hopper's mind.
Oh, I'm sure he was like, damn. Hell, Lynch, I guess we're going there,
I've got my head in between Ingrid Bergman's daughter's legs.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I've got a
lot. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
There's still more history with Isabella. You probably know this story. He was introduced to her at a restaurant by a mutual friend. Did you know that? Mm-hmm. Okay. He was beautiful. He said, you could be Ingrid Bergman's daughter. And his friend said, you idiot. She is Ingrid Bergman's daughter.
She is.
Yeah. And like I said, they were engaged for 4 years. And last March, after his death, Rossellini attended the Academy Awards because she was nominated, yes, and she wore blue velvet in honor of him.
She wore blue velvet for David.
I thought that was sweet.
That was a great touch. Yeah.
Kyle MacLachlan, we know him from a lot of things, including Twin Peaks and now Dune, which Lynch also directed, and the new show Fallout that's been on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime,
And I know him from doing small roles, too. Like, he was one of the boyfriends on Sex and the City, things like that.
Well, and he's one of the boyfriends in Showgirls.
That's right. That's right. The role of Jeffrey was originally offered to Val Kilmer. He turned it down and described the script as pornography. Which really...
pretty close.
It blows my mind that happened. Because Val Kilmer had a very good relationship with Marlon Brando. And Marlon Brando did Last Tango in Paris, which is similar in theme. And it seems like Val Kilmer would have been into doing a movie like this. So I say it's Val Kilmer's loss for not doing it.
I would think so. I think it would also, he would have... I think he would have enjoyed it more had he done it rather than being so subjective to begin.
Right.
He would have been interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Coincidentally, Kilmer was in the running to play Paul Atreides. Is that his name? Atreides. Yeah. Uh-huh. In Lynch's Dune. And that role also went to Kyle MacLachlan. Chris Isaac was up for the role of Jeffrey Beaumont, but he turned it down. He did later show up on Twin Peaks, didn't he? I think he did.
Yeah. He was a he was a cop on Twin Peaks.
Right. Lynch used two of his songs from the 1985 debut album in the movie, maybe in credits. I don't know when it is. Dennis Hopper plays Frank.
Ah.
And, of course, we know him, God almighty. He's been around forever.
Yep.
He was here before this, but the first thing I can think of is the movie Giant with Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah.
But he also, in the 60s, became a cult favorite with things like
Easy Rider.
In the 90s, he became a villain character with movies like Speed. Actually, he was a villain character in the 80s, and that's probably why they cast him as a villain in Speed, because of this film.
And in the 70s, it was Apocalypse Now.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's been around for a good long while. He's got quite a pedigree. Other people were considered for this role as well. Willem Dafoe was one of them. I could see that.
I could easily see that.
Because Willem Dafoe is quite scary at times.
Oh, yeah.
Another person that really wanted to play the role but did not get it was Robert Loggia.
Oh.
Yeah.
That would have been interesting. A very much more mafioso kind of way to do it.
Yeah. Even though he didn't get cast, Lynch later wrote a part for him in Lost Highway. So he is in Lost Highway. Stephen Burkoff was David Lynch's first choice for Frank Booth. Bet you didn't realize we'd be talking about him again. He was in Outland. No. We talked about him a few episodes back.
Yep.
When he rejected it, the role went to Dennis Hopper. Berkoff said there was nothing in that part except destruction. And I think I said that when we were covering Outland. Another person that I love, I'm not sure if I could see him in this part that was, he auditioned, was Tom Noonan. Tom Noonan was in House of the Devil, the Ty West movie, and he played John Lee Roach, the serial killer, in one of my favorite X-Files episodes, Paper Hearts. But he's very tall, so I'm not sure how that would have worked with the dynamic.
Interesting, yeah.
I like that Frank's short.
I'm also not sure how much of it was in the script for audition sort of thing for these people to take a good assessment of, because I think a lot of this came about in script development and on set, the nitrous huffing and the whole saying fuck every other word sort of thing all the way. And I think Hopper probably added a lot of that.
That was one of my next notes. Dennis Hopper says fuck in nearly every sentence. He is the only one to use the word in this film, except for Dean Stockwell, who says it once on command by Dennis Hopper's character. The word fuck is used 56 times in this movie, all by Dennis Hopper, except for once. What else?
Yeah, and again, I think that's Lynch, the writer-director, saying, I want to be offensive. I want this to offend people. I want them to jerk back from
To have no doubt that this guy is the bad guy.
Not just that. I think he could have easily done that without the language or just with a little bit of the language. I think when you do an entire end of a sequence, again, that sequence at the, quote, brothel or whatever the club was, and you do this big push into Frank Booth's face, and he just goes, fuck, and they all disappear, literally disappear in the frame as a cut. That's a statement. You as a director, like you said, indulgent, you are saying, ah, look at this. I got away with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Lastly, talking on the phone with David Lynch after reading Blue Velvet, Dennis Hopper said, you have to let me play Frank because I am Frank.
See, that's kind of scary. It's very scary. I don't know if I want to, even if you did have the darker tendencies, I don't know if you'd want to have
maybe
that quoted.
Lynch cast him because he was afraid Dennis was going to kill him if he didn't.
Kill him. Yeah. Hold him tight for me, boys.
Oh, my God. Laura Dern played Sandy. When Laura Dern did this movie, she was relatively unknown. She had done some work, but nothing of note. By the way, I listened to a podcast recently that Dennis loves, the podcast Spartless, with Jason Bateman, Will Arnett, and Sean.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Hayes. Had Laura Dern on there because she recently did a movie with Will that's getting a lot of critical acclaim that's out there. And it was a fascinating interview with her, listening to her talk about Bruce Dern and Diane Ladd, her parents, and how she grew up on sets and how she always wanted to be an actress. And she was on the Family Plot set with Alfred Hitchcock. She knew Alfred Hitchcock as a little girl. So it's really interesting that she grew up in Hollywood and has become the actress that she is. I just watched her on Palm Royale. She's got a big part on that as well.
He put her in the third season of Twin Peaks, The Return.
Yeah. We know her, of course, from when we covered Jurassic Park a while back, but she's also been in things like Wild at Heart, which is another David Lynch film, Rambling Rose, she got critical acclaim for, and she's in the most famous episode of Ellen, the one where Ellen came out. She's the puppy episode, they call it, Ellen DeGeneres. Mm. As I mentioned, she's the daughter of Diane Ladd and Bruce Dern. There was another person up for this role who was very popular at the time, but her mother objected to her starring in it due to the graphic content of the film. Would you like to take a guess?
No, I have no clue.
Molly Ringwald.
Yeah, I could understand that.
I could see Molly do the part. I easily could see her do the part. But I'm glad it's Laura, because Laura has that small town Americana look to her.
Yeah.
She really, the blonde hair, blue eye kind of look. So that's cool. Who's next? I have Hope Lang is in this movie. Hope Lang, mm-hmm. I know because she was an actress of my mother's generation, and my mother used to watch her on a show called Peyton Plays, which, as we know, Stephen King is referenced in Salem's Lot.
Yep.
She never really went on to do a lot, though, past Peyton Plays. She was in the movie Bus Stop before that, but then she went on to do, like, genre picks like Death Wish and things like that. She plays Mrs. Williams. Dean Stockwell is in this film. He plays, as you mentioned, he was also in Dune because Lynch does like to cast similar or the same people over and over again. He was in Paris, Texas. He probably got more famous with Quantum Leap and was when he was on television more often.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I remember him from the Dunwich Horror, which is like a cult movie from the 60s. It's a Lovecraft movie. He has 205 acting credits. He began as a child in Abbott and Costello movies.
Wow.
That is crazy.
Yep.
I've got that he began his career in the 1940s. His friend and frequent castmate was Russ Tamblyn, whom he remained friends with into adulthood. He invited Tamblyn as a guest to a party promoting this film where Tamblyn met David Lynch and expressed an interest in working with him. Lynch responded, maybe on the next project, which turned out to be Twin Peaks. And that's how Tamblyn ended up on that show.
There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's a cool connection. I put her in here just because I recognized her, but Frances Bay is in this movie.
Yeah.
She's got 181 credits, and she's just a very familiar television face. And we saw her in something not too long ago. I can't remember what it was.
We saw her in Mouth of Madness. She was Pickman. She was the woman who owned the hotel.
Okay, you're right. That's it, exactly, when we did the Mouth of Madness.
That's what I remembered her from. Also, she was in Twin Peaks. She had a cameo in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And she's one of those faces. As soon as you see her, you go, oh, yeah, I know who that character is.
And then who is the guy from Eraserhead? I forgot his name. I didn't put him in.
Jack
Nance and Brad Dourif have very small parts in this movie. I didn't know Jack Nance at the time, but because I watched Eraserhead last night. However, Brad Dourif, I absolutely adore. He's another one that's in an X-Files episode that's one of my favorites. Played Billy Bibbit in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was also in Dune. He was Chucky in Child's Play. He was Hazel Motes in Wise Blood. He's also in the Lord of the Rings movie, The Two Towers, that we covered not too long ago. He's still with us, and he has 176 credits, including, as I mentioned, Luther Lee Boggs on Beyond the Sea, the X-Files episode, season 1.
There is an episode of Babylon 5 that he is in that you would love because the thematic of it is he's a priest, and he arrives on Babylon 5 with all these other priests, and somebody recognizes him, and they start delving into it, and you find out that he is actually a multiple serial killer who has been caught, convicted, and his conviction was to have his mind wiped, and he has to serve the rest of his sentence as a priest. And the whole episode is about the morality of that and is the mind wipe working? Because we start having murders on Babylon 5. Ooh. So it's a pseudo mystery, everything else. It's a really cool episode.
Cool.
But Dourif, again, playing what he plays best, which is that psychotic sort of
secondary characters.
Yeah.
He was a great secondary character in the Jim Jones movie with Powers Booth.
Yeah.
He and Jack Nance are henchmen for Frank in this. So they're side characters basically in this as well. I just love him. He's great. That's all I have other than keys and trivia. Did you have anything on cast you want to mention before?
Nothing. Let me check my notes real quick. I don't think I have anything else on really cast other than, like I mentioned before, I love Jack Nance. He really only has two lines, and it's, my name is Ben or whatever. That's it. But he does it in such a way that you go, okay, that guy is a freaking Looney Tune.
Yeah.
No, I don't have anything else cast-wise. No.
Let's see. Apparently, this film was originally 4 hours long. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but I don't know why.
Despite many searches, the missing 2 hours of deleted scenes was thought to be lost until 2011, when Lynch announced the footage had been found and was reissued on the Blu-ray. On the 2011 Blu-ray, they added 50 minutes, almost an hour, of deleted scenes, including Jeffrey at a college party before his dad's heart attack, a woman lighting her nipples on fire at the brothel that Frank brings Dorothy and Jeffrey to, many more scenes like the Beaumont household, inside the Beaumont household, where the mother and aunt are there. That's the character I was just mentioning, Frances Bay, is that her name?
Yeah.
Francis. Jeffrey having dinner at the Williams house, a conversation between Jeffrey and Dorothy, wherein Dorothy brings Jeffrey up to the roof of her apartment, followed by a lovemaking session, and many more. Among these deleted scenes, Jeffrey has, in one of these scenes of Jeffrey at college before he comes home in the aftermath of his father's stroke, he has a girlfriend who was cut completely out of the movie and never mentioned. Guess who played her?
Sherilyn Finn. I don't know.
Megan Mullally from Will and Grace.
Really?
Yes. And I remembered around that time she did About Last Night with Rob Lowe and Demi Moore and James Belushi. So she was just coming onto the scene around that time. She would have been very young. And I just think that's cool that she was in this movie and got cut.
Yeah.
That's all the trivia I have, really. As far as awards, Lynch was nominated for Best Director that year for an Academy Award. It's the only film that year that was nominated for Best Director, but not Best Picture. It won the grand prize at the Avoriaz Film Festival, and there were many other wins. 4 for the Boston Society of Film Critics Awards, 2 for the Sitges Catalonian Film Fest Awards, and 2 Los Angeles Film Critic Awards, and on. The film is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, and I can probably see why.
I have just some watch note trivia and stuff, like you talked about. There are certain things that, to I think both of us, kind of show this as David Lynch is much better as a small movie director, not a big movie director. And he's probably much better at a television sort of process than a 4-hour feature length Light Your Nipples on Fire process.
Yeah.
Just because there's so much incongruity in the movie. There's so much things that don't work. I was even thrown off. I've got in my notes. Wait, she's a high school senior. We established that. Mm-hmm. And yet they go to a club on their first date and they're drinking beers and everything else.
And she's the cop's daughter, the detective's daughter. Yeah.
She's the detective's daughter. I think it's a cool idea to have him not be able to hear her beep the warning shots on the horn, but you're invading a strange person's apartment and you decide to go take a piss? I just don't understand that either, why you would do that.
You gotta go. You gotta go. You'd be
more concerned about getting out of there. There's so much eccentricity that's just shown and not explained. Like Frank, and even what he is inhaling, we don't know what he's inhaling. We know from research and looking back at it that amyl nitrate.
It was originally going to be nitrous oxide, but they changed it to amyl nitrate, which makes more sense. I would think nitrous oxide, you wouldn't be that sadistic. Amyl nitrate, you could be, probably.
And in the original, according to my notes, in the original script, it was helium.
Oh, and that's right. I'm sorry. I said nitrous oxide, and I meant helium. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because helium doesn't change your mind. It changes your voice, whereas amyl nitrate would change your mind.
Yeah. But yeah, we never know why Frank does that, what the purpose of it is, whatever. There's just all kinds of weird, like I said, Isabella Rossellini literally jabs the knife into his cheek and he starts bleeding. And he bleeds for that entire scene. Mm. The next scene is him talking and telling Sandy everything and has no cut. And then the next scene, he's going to see the detective and he has a small dot where the cut would be. Then he gets, and also the other thing too, get the crap literally beat out of you, so much so that we have to do a close-up of you with a swollen eye and all this kind of stuff. And then in the very next scene, which is the same night, he has no problem going to the dance with Sandy and There's no black eye even. There's nothing.
No, he's very pristine in this whole movie.
Am I in a dream? What is happening?
I mean, he is milk toast in this movie. And even when he is naked, he is white. He is so white.
Yeah. He a white boy. Yeah.
But like you said, I think that goes back to the whole thing about him being, David Lynch, that is, being indulgent. I don't think he lets things like continuity bother him. So once he got this kind of clout as a director, he should have hired people to take care of that stuff for him. Make sure the continuity's right in this, because I'm not going to be thinking about it.
Yeah. I'm going to let them do whatever they want to, and then we'll go from there.
Because it is jarring, like you said, that things disappear or a scar is not there or cut is not there, that kind of thing.
If you ever feel the need to dive into self-indulgence, watch the, quote, third season of Twin Peaks.
Oh, I will, eventually.
It is insanely self-indulgent.
Okay.
I think there's one shot that is literally just like one of Lynch's typical angled corner, augmented artsy-looking
curtains,
dilapidated houses. And it's a lockdown shot for 18 minutes, and no one enters, no dialogue, nothing. You're just supposed to absorb the presence.
I'm totally out. Yeah.
It is mm-hmm. so indulgent. And this, I think, a good segue before we do Keys, as part of Keys, is I wanted to talk a little bit about Lynch and some of the themes you mentioned already. This says, the one I found online, which I thought was pretty precise about this, which kind of borders into Lynch himself. 2 points. One is, this movie represents human fascination with perversion and forbidden knowledge, which I think that's pretty concise. And the other take on it was from another reviewer who said, the message here is clear. Perfection often hides deeply rooted rot. Dreams can easily turn into nightmares. Corruption is everywhere, even in places that seem immune to it. These themes and others about the pernicious influence of evil are explored throughout Blue Velvet. I went, yep, that pretty much sums it up. And that is Twin Peaks as well. And that is Eraserhead to a point. That's definitely Elephant Man. Mm-hmm. And I've just got so let me get your listing if you've seen them and what you think. So this is my Lynch repertoire. So Eraserhead, obviously you've seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen it too. I don't like it. His next movie was Elephant Man. Elephant Man is one of my favorite movies.
I can't think it's remember great. If I have seen it. If I've not seen it, I've seen enough parts of it to have seen it. Does that make sense?
You should watch it. Yeah. John Hurt is brilliant in it. Anthony Hopkins. It's a great movie. And it is, again, very constrained. It's still got Lynchism in it, which we'll talk about in a second, but it's very constrained. And tells a great story. And I think a lot of that is Mel Brooks's influence because he produced it.
Right.
So Elephant Man, yes. Then the next one is Dune. And that's there's some things I like about it and some things I don't. We've already covered it on the show. Next one is Blue Velvet. I would list this as a no. This is not one of my favorite movies or a good movie. Next two, though, Wild at Heart. I actually liked Wild at Heart.
I liked Wild at Heart.
And I like Twin Peaks. Loved Twin Peaks.
I love the first season for sure.
And then he starts flipping again. So his next one is Lost Highway. Don't like that one.
I
at
haven't
all.
Seen any of the ones after Twin Peaks.
Next one is Mulholland Drive. I do like. Really, Mulholland Drive is Lynch trying to do Hitchcock.
Okay.
That's my take on it. I think you would like it. The next one, though, is Inland Empire, which was terrible and was shot, I think, on like Super 8. It was shot like with phone cameras or something. It was terrible. And then Twin Peaks of Return, which I've already said is bad.
Okay.
So it's amazing with that small a repertoire, he has such a
hit and miss.
Yeah. But such a reputation and such respect in the cinematic community. To have such a hit and miss record, it's not like a Spielberg or a Lucas or a Coppola or a Scorsese.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about his personal demeanor at all, which is everyone said he was like a giddy little kid. He's like one of the friendliest people you could ever possibly meet. And yet he directed these really dark visions.
Very dark. And like I said, I think that's that one phrase of human fascination with perversion and forbidden knowledge. That is David Lynch.
Yeah. He said this movie alone was constituted on three obsessions of his. One was the song Blue Velvet. One was his idea of somebody finding an ear in a field. And the other, I think, was the voyeurism from the closet.
Of course.
And that's what this movie evolved from, those three notions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But think, in different hands, if this script even, or a version of this script, had been done by De Palma, it would have been much more voyeuristic.
It would have been sexier.
Hitchcock was very
too.
Voyeuristic. This one's pretty sexy, but it's that dark, twisted sexy.
Yeah. It's like a fetishism type sexy. Yeah.
Correct. When you're right in the throes and suddenly your partner says, hit me. Might be time to rethink the relationship.
Yeah. Or I'll poke you with a knife again.
Yeah. But so there's things.
Keys.
My first keys is everything I just listed. I think all of that is extremely influenced by and influenced him. So I do think he was influenced by his experience with Eraserhead, Elephant Man, Dune, which led to Velvet. And I think the experience that came, all the stuff that came from Velvet led to Twin Peaks.
I think that Dune in particular, because Dune was such a massive failure on many levels, massive as far as cast and scope, but also as far as money.
Oh, yeah.
It forced him to go back to what he's good at, which is small films and weirdness. And that's why this movie came about. Yeah, I agree totally. He's influenced by himself.
And what has happened with his previous work. Right. I do think the grandiosity of Dune and the failure of it reset his thinking of, I need to tell my own little intimate story.
Yeah, I need to get back to what made me good. Yeah.
Which, like, I'm sure Joe Powell and other cinephiles and everything else would say he's a great artist and he's amazing and he's incredible and look at all this stuff he's done. But
some of it's self-indulgent and not good. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I have, and you've already mentioned him, Alfred Hitchcock. For a couple of films in particular, Shadow of a Doubt, which we covered a couple seasons back on this podcast, which is the whole pleasant, idyllic little town and the seedy underbelly of what's really going on. That's exactly what Hitchcock was going for in that film. But also Psycho, where you have a mentally deranged killer, and Frank is a mentally deranged killer in this as well, like Norman Bates in Psycho.
Yeah. Yeah. I think another one I have, you mentioned already, is Peyton Place. I think Peyton Place was a huge influence on Lynch and obviously an influence on this and Twin Peaks and a lot of the stories he tells of like that rural town underbelly, which Peyton Place turned it into literally a soap opera. So it was mostly infidelity and stuff like that happening. But if you think about infidelity, it's all over this movie, especially since you said that in the original thing, he had a girlfriend.
Yeah. And so he's screwing around on her, and then he's screwing around on Laura Dern with Dorothy. Yeah, he's screwing with three women in this.
Yeah, and but
off screen.
Yeah, and Dorothy's character is screwing with him and Frank when she's married to Dom, sort of thing. And so there's a lot of that in there. You mentioned the scenes missing, and I could easily see that those scenes in my head.
You can see them. They're on the DVD.
His aunt and his mom just sitting there talking or knitting or doing something mundane while he's sneaking out to go sleep with a singer and investigate her murderous lover.
Right. And it's funny, I don't know that Salem's Lot would be a direct key, but it is a key to Peyton Place. I guess it would be, because it's like you've got a small idyllic town, but something evil is happening underneath instead of something nefarious. One's vampires, one's killers, but they're both killers, essentially. Yeah, I think Salem's Lot actually would be a key to this movie.
I think you could use Midnight Mass too, because they're on that island and left there, and darkness is growing underneath them.
It's festering, yes. And it's slowly getting over and consuming. Yeah, and back to what I've already said for you folks, hopefully I'm not boring you. Stephen King literally said, I want to take Peyton Place and turn it on its head. And here, David Lynch not only does that, but he actually casts one of the leads from Peyton Place in the movie, Hope Lange. So it's just interesting. Yep. It's very meta, so to speak.
Yep. I have just lots of Lynch tropes, which are things that are in all of his movies, including a science fiction one like Dune, or whether it's television or film or whatever, which is, you mentioned it at the very beginning, his sound design. He is very big into ambient and atmospheric sounds. Mm-hmm. Even if we are, yeah, even if we are in a car just doing a normal little dialogue scene, if it's at night, I want to hear crickets in the background. If it's during the day, I want to hear wind. Even if that's not, I want to hear just undertones of single drones.
A drone, or something. Yeah.
He does a lot of droning in general, a lot of mechanized droning. So, which to me reminded me, a key is back to A Girl Who Walked Home Alone at Night.
A girl, yeah.
The whole suddenly cutting to the big oil rigs drilling. And
yeah. Yeah, I see that.
That's very David Lynch trope. He does that a lot with the logs and the saws and everything in Twin Peaks, as with the highway and Lost Highway and with the sounds in the apartment. So he's big into sound design. He's big into ambient noise. He's big into dreams. Dreams, i.e. nightmares, are these kind of weird visual montages that he throws together. They're all through all of his
films. He uses them as like transitions.
Correct.
It's really weird. He goes from scene to scene and then like throws some weird dream in between them sometimes.
Yeah. And it's not one of those where I'm watching something very graphic or weird or strange and then suddenly my character wakes up and I realize it's suddenly, no, then we're just into a different scene.
Yeah.
I just threw that in there in the middle.
Yeah.
So you would go, what the hell is going on?
Do with it what you will.
It's that artsy approach Bill Pitts and I used to talk about. Yeah. It's a blue ball, Bill. That's all it is a freaking blue ball.
No, it's anyway, red curtains. It's red curtains.
Which, again, another problem with this movie. It keeps cutting to that little, to the edge of her apartment, and the red curtains are moving. And you think somebody's back there. We never find out. We never look at it. It never happens. It just is. Anyway, so dreams, industrial sounds, small towns. He likes rural, small communities. Even when he does Mulholland Drive, which is set in Los Angeles, basically most of the story takes place in this one little set of apartments, almost like a 90210 gated community thing. And but underneath that is murder, backstory, dark shadows, something's going on, all of
kinky
that.
Kinky sex.
Yeah. Voyeurism in almost all of his movies. Seedy dive bars are in all of his movies. Even in Dune, there's a couple where it's the Fremen tent one, but it's like a bar kind of thing in it. And he also has this weird eclectic use of, quote, pop or lyrical music. In the again, whether it's a transition or not, he'll suddenly cut to somebody performing a song, usually a female. And it's usually a very slow, ballady kind of song. But he has that in Wild at Heart. He has that in
Twin Peaks. Doesn't Julie Cruz do some in Twin Peaks?
She does. Yeah, she does a lot of Julie Cruz. A lot of the music.
I know the music is her, but isn't she actually in it too, though?
Yeah.
I thought so.
She's on stage performing at the bar. So those are just, I guess that to me they are keys, because when I see sequences like that, I immediately think of David Lynch. And that's an influence that he has now given to other people. Because we've seen it in other movies since the 90s, where Cronenberg is one, but there are others where there's a lot of atmospheric indulgence, I guess, maybe you call it.
I have so Mike Flanagan, because Mike Flanagan, Lynch likes his own little cadre of actors that he reuses in film to film. It evolves. He takes and gives. He'll bring someone new in, but he'll keep a lot of his core, or vice versa. But he's usually got the same people orbiting him, very much like Mike Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And there's probably other examples of that, too.
That's a great one. I think Flanagan's a great one. I've got that David Lynch has said he was obsessed. Part of his films are his obsession with The Wizard of Oz. He said,
okay,
I gave me obsessions with dreams and female identities from The Wizard of Oz.
It's interesting that you should say that, because I've got that the Dorothy Valens character was inspired by the story of Judy Garland, who was, you know, a tragic drug addicted singer that had had projected the Peyton Plays pristine image, but was seedy a little bit underneath, so to speak.
I have got David Chase, who you know from Psych, maybe?
No, I know him from Sopranos.
Sopranos. David Chase, Damon Lindelof, who did Lost, and Noah Hawley, who you like a lot for Fargo, have all said that Twin Peaks influenced them making television and how you make a television show.
I can see that, but Noah Hawley is not indulgent. He's great.
Until he did Alien.
Need to see Fargo. And some of it may be indulgent, but it's not like extraneous. It's usually there for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The actual quote I have from David Chase is, quote, anybody making one-hour dramas today who says he wasn't influenced by David Lynch is lying.
Oh. And I tend to agree with him. Lynch did do something you've never seen before on television. That's for sure.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it became hugely culturally popular before the internet was big and before all of that happened. It was a huge cultural touchstone. And commend ABC for doing it to begin with. Yeah.
I've got film noir.
Yes. Could easily see that.
There's a very film noir feel to this movie. The only one I could think of was Night of the Hunter, which I have mentioned before. And like Shadow of a Doubt, Night of the Hunter is a little sanitized for now. We've seen so much more seediness in films since the old black and white films. But Night of the Hunter is a little gruesome. And this one features a femme fatale with the Dorothy Valens character, a morally ambiguous hero, and an unstoppable villain. And that's a motif of all film noir movies. I think it would be really interesting, even though this is a beautiful color movie, I would love to see this movie in black and white. It would have been really interesting how this movie would have looked in black and white.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like that shot of him behind me right now looking through the blinds. I could easily see that done in black and white.
But. This goes along with the music. So another, to your point about his stable of actors, he also almost exclusively used Angelo Badalamenti for a lot of his music. And Julie Cruz for a lot of things. But it is said that they created what's called, in my notes, it ended up being called Dream Pop, which is a cool kind of thing.
I already mentioned X-Files because of the yellow-suited man and the well-dressed man and those obscure, like, character names for people that don't really have names. That's a very X-Files thing. But the last thing I have, and I don't really know how to sum it up. I don't want to read this because it's too long. But there's a very psychoanalytic approach to analyzing this movie. Or to discussing this movie or whatever. One woman suggests that there's a metaphorical Oedipal family between Beaumont and his parents, Frank and Dorothy.
I didn't get that.
I didn't either. I just thought it was interesting. And then there's a Freudian approach as well, where it's the expression of the traumatized innocence with characteristics. No, excuse me, which characterizes Lynch's work. He states Dorothy represents the sexual force of the mother because she is forbidden and because she becomes the object of the unhealthy infantile impulses at work in Jeffrey's subconscious. There's some people putting some really deep shit into this movie that I'm wondering if it's a little excessive. Does that make sense?
Again, I think that tends to happen sometimes with artsy movies.
Yes,
where
exactly.
To justify the art, we have to find something in it.
And this was a response.
No, Bill, it's a blue dot.
Yeah, this was a response I found online somewhere. And the first one about the Oedipal thing was a feminist psychoanalyst. And then the Freudian, I guess, may have been male. I don't know. But anyway, I don't necessarily agree with it, but this is what other people have tried to read into it.
I didn't finish my thing about the music, but basically this dream pop supposedly influenced and has been attributed to influence people like Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails and Lana Del Rey and The Veils, and all of them have this kind of dream pop sort of quality, which is true.
Well, Trent Reznor's is more nightmare, but Lana Del Rey would definitely be a dream pop for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Interesting.
Any more keys from you?
No, that's all I have. Basically, that's it. We're back to the
ear. You said Cronenberg, right? We got Cronenberg on there for everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I have been talking about Cronenberg since we started, but yeah.
But yeah, but again, one of the, from body horror to twisted elements to storytelling that is bizarre and throws you off. Yeah, very similar. But that's what, you know, Tim and I think. We would love to know what you guys think about that. Do you like David Lynch? Do you like all of his films? Do you like any of his films? Do you like most of his films?
Or do you like Eraserhead?
What do you think? Do you like Eraserhead? What do you think about Blue Velvet? Do you think there would ever have been a Twin Peaks without Blue Velvet? Of course not. Mm-hmm. You have to think that. But anyway, let us know down below in the comments. And also click, like, share, do all those kind of things. Ring the bell so you subscribe. That way we can keep in touch with you. You can keep in touch with us. We're available to reach by email, of course, if you don't want to do a comment down below. We'd love to have your thoughts about movies that we should cover on the show. We are working on planning out next season and what that's going to be like. So give us some suggestions of stuff. And also, we could always use your support. So if you want to go to Patreon, we have a Patreon channel there with some free content as well as some other higher tier stuff. But as cheap as a cup of coffee a month, you could help us continue to do this and continue to go into next season and keep our software up to date and all that fun stuff that we have to do and try to keep the evil AI bots out of everything. So we do it ourselves. And Tim, I guess until next time, what are we doing? Are we doing fun next time?
Well, we're winding down the season. Our next one is 1, 2, 3. We've got 6 films left this season. And the next one, we're going back into horror country, but it's in the 1980s. So it's an older film. And it's actually, in my opinion, a pretty good one. So I'm looking forward to it.
All right. We'll look forward to it. I look forward to seeing you then.
All right. I'll see you then.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.